And so that means that I can start the local recording. And with the local recording having begun, then we go and we do the best part of the show, really, is the truth of the matter. I'm embarrassed to say it, but this is it's all downhill from here. To Surreal Politiques. Oh, I know exactly what it is. Hang on a second. I'm going to fix... I know what happened. I know what the problem is with Rumble. Stand by a second, guys. I'm very sorry for this. But I know exactly how to fix it, fortunately. And we'll fix it right now. And then Rumble will work. You know, that's really annoying. That's very, very, very annoying. But we're clever people over here, fortunately. And so, boom, there. Rumble's going to start working right now. Almost there, guys. There we go. So now Rumble's going to start to work. Isn't that beautiful? Well, maybe I spoke too soon. My streaming application says that it's streaming to Rumble, and Rumble should be working, but, you know, I'm the only one who has to, do what he's supposed to do. Everybody else just, you know, they just do whatever whatever works, you know? So, ladies and gentlemen, if Rumble doesn't start working... Oh, here we go. All right, now it's going to play a couple advertisements, which means that for the last 2 minutes, it's been, you know, it's had my stream, but it just needed to hang on to it for a little while before it played the advertisements, and then after the advertisements play, then it'll start, starting now. Okay, sorry, ladies and gentlemen. Live television, you know, broadcasting, not television per se, but, you know, same idea, you know what I mean? And so, that's just one of the many things that we have to go through around here to get the show going. 217-688-1433, if you would like to be on this 50th episode of the first stage of Surreal Politiques for March 18th, 2024, being the current year. It's a Monday as usual, 9:30 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time. Join us for the live show if you're listening on some other platform at some other time. I'd love to hear from you. And, of course, you can, if you desire to, if you're not able to make the live shows, you can leave me a voicemail. The number to do that is usually right here. Where is it? Where's the number? Anyway, so... /contact. The number to call if you want to leave me a voicemail is 202-599-7386. That's the voicemail line. You can call the during the show. It's 217-688-1433. But the voicemail line is 202-599-7386. Leave me a voicemail, and if it's worthy, I'll play it on the air. Try not to run out the 3-minute timer. Get it in under 3 minutes. We would love for you to do that, and then we could have your participation, which would be great. And it would be especially great to have your participation because in the last week, I basically had what could charitably be described as a stubborn and persistent writer's block. And so I figured today we're basically just going to do news phones. I might try to pull up the OMI TV thing. I don't know if I can actually, I'm not 100% certain I'll be able to get it working in the course of a broadcast. I spent, when my creativity is not up to snuff. I try to work on tech things. And, you know, I've been using the AI image generator at Midjourney, which is great. It's in a lot of ways, it's great because it works very well for the things that Midjourney will allow you to produce, right? And having obtained a bit of, you know, what might be described as minor celebrity, the Midjourney and other AI image generators, if you tell it, have Christopher Cantwell do X, Y, and Z, it doesn't exactly give you an image of me doing it because there's me, and then there's me from 15 years ago who looks completely different, and then there's a guy who writes like comic books who is not nearly as talented as I am. And so what happens when you do the Midjourney AI generator? You get, it looks like me and this dude had a baby, and the baby's fat. And that's not what we really want, right? But you can do something called what they call a LoRA, LORA, low rank adaptation model. And that says, hey, like before you get into your whole data set, we're going to override that at a lower level that whenever you see Christopher Cantwell, this is the information that you're going to use. And so I have this folder basically with all the pictures that I have of myself. And I'm beginning to train this, what's called the LoRA model to produce images of Christopher Cantwell. So then I could just say, hey, Christopher Cantwell here, Christopher Cantwell doing this. And it will give you an actual, representation of me in some fashion. And it's kind of cool because you can also do like style LoRAs, right? So a lot of the images that you see me do for show art, I say to do it in Grand Theft Auto style. Okay. So I say, give me this character and put him in Grand Theft Auto style. And then I'll use that for the show art if I'm trying to talk about a character on the show. And so you can have these things and then you could do the character in different styles, you know, which I think is going to be a lot of fun. But it's a technically involved task, and I didn't actually get it 100% complete today. But I did try. So Omi TV. So the Omi TV thing, I'll talk about that in a minute. That's distracting me. The other thing that we can do is you could do the same thing with text. It's a different process. But, you know, I've told you before, I've produced over 9,000 pages of original text in the course of my career. That's a lot of stuff, and that's not even counting the show transcripts, right? So you can have a LoRA for the text generators that says, okay, here's how to write like Christopher Cantwell, you know, write it in this style. And that's a little scary to me, if I'm entirely honest with you, because, you know, you could have the text generator generate text that reads very much like Christopher Cantwell, and then you can go to these voice cloning things that will clone my voice. If you've ever heard this, somebody sent me a thing of me saying like, oh, I'm in Afghanistan. I've got four wives. It's like the greatest thing ever. And I was like, oh, I don't remember that. Was I drunk? What happened? Oh no, it's one of these voice cloning things. There's a guy on Odyssey. I think he also streams to Goyim TV by the name of Flood. He does these great like news clips. So he goes through the whole thing. He clones the voice of the news personality. And then he goes and he gets the video of the news and he puts it through this thing that I think it's called 11 Labs. It syncs the lips to the audio that you have. So he writes a script. He has the voice read the script. And then he has the lips of the characters in the video move to fit the script. Wow. And you might have heard, you know, there was a thing where some guys did like a whole Joe Rogan podcast as Joe Rogan. And he, of course, begins it by saying, I am not Joe Rogan, but yada, yada, yada. It's kind of scary. You know, you think about the power of that technology. You hear about these stories of like parents getting the call from their screaming, crying teenage daughter that she's been kidnapped and she needs their help, you know, and you find out that that's not true, that it's somebody was screwing with them, They cloned the daughter's voice. They made this basically ransom call. And that's one of the reasons. I mean, you know, I don't think that the hearsay rules in a court of law were developed necessarily with this in mind. But you can't, like, play it. You just can't, like, bring video into a courtroom and play it. The rules of evidence in a court of law have something called hearsay. And hearsay is not what you think of as hearsay. Like, the hearsay rule is, you know, pretty complex, as a matter of fact. So if you have a video, the only way that you can get that video into evidence is to have somebody testify to the authenticity of the video in a capacity where they are in a position to do it, okay? And even at that, the thing might only be allowed in for a limited purpose. And this was actually the subject of my appeal in my criminal case in New Hampshire, well, my federal criminal case in a New Hampshire district court. There was an audio recording of me speaking to a woman, and they brought in the recording of me and the woman, and the woman's voice is on the recording only for the purpose of putting my statement in context, okay? They're not allowed to use her statement as evidence because she's not a witness in the trial. But they used her statement as evidence. The appeals court agreed with me and were like, yeah, but, you know, you're going to prison anyway. You're already done. We're not going to overturn your conviction because, yeah, they cheated, but you're guilty. So why would we care? Those rules are important, especially as these things come to fruition, right? If you've got an audio of me saying something and you bring that audio into a courtroom, you know, am I confessing to a crime? No, it's something that some guy on Odyssey made to have me confess to taking brides in Afghanistan. I have no idea what you're talking about. So unless they can authenticate that audio, it's not usable in court. And we should all be very grateful for that. 217-688-1433. You like to be on the program, and the more you talk, the less I have to, so please do give us a call. And so I'm looking forward to this thing. You can even do them with videos now, you know. I don't know how complex you could really get with it. I was using a thing called Easy Diffusion, which, all right, so most of the image generators use a thing called Stable Diffusion, and there's different interfaces for that. And I had a thing on here called Easy Diffusion, and it was not working well at all. It's like, this thing sucks. Like, why am I, you know, I went and I bought a better video card, and I'm thinking that this is going to do it. And I'm like, I got a better video card, and this thing creates crappy images much faster, which is not satisfying at all. But I got this thing. This one's a lot better. And this is actually not the best one that I have, but I'll show you this here. So this is Christopher Cantwell carrying a large rifle down a city street. And in the negative prompt, which is like, don't put these things in here. So let me do it without the negative prompt, actually. I'll generate another one of these. So we see this happen in a matter of, does it give me the time here? It took 7 seconds to create that image. And here we have what they think is Christopher Cantwell carrying a rifle down a city street. So they think that Christopher Cantwell's fat, and I don't really appreciate that. So I'm going to go in here and I'm going to put, this is a negative prompt. Don't put in the things that are in the negative prompt. And so I'm going to put in fat and we'll generate another image. And then you can see I get a little bit thinner. But it still doesn't really have a very good image of my face, you know. Sometimes we've had a bit of luck if we say podcast host Christopher Cantwell. Let's see if that comes up with anything better. I'd say that does, right? Because it doesn't know the difference unless I specify it here. It doesn't know the difference between me and the comic book guy, right? If I put in the podcast host thing, it understands a little bit better. The guns in this one are not so good. I have another image generation application that's actually pretty sophisticated that you can actually alter like parts of the image. You bring the image in, you kind of like highlight, you'd be like, change this part of it, change that part of it. It's pretty cool. So I'm looking forward to trying to get these things in a more functional fashion than they presently are. You know, the Midjourney thing, when you use it, I put up a thing a while back titled Political Bias in AI is Worse Than I Had Thought, because I went over to this Midjourney thing and I'm trying to get it to do basically like a donkey getting beat up by an elephant, say. And the image generator wouldn't do it. I'm like, what are you talking about? And I tried all these different prompts and it wouldn't even put the donkey in an image with any other animal. It would do it with an elephant, but not the donkey. I'm like, this thing is protecting the mascot of the Democrat Party by refusing to place it in an image with another animal. You can't put a donkey in a cat. You can't put a donkey in a dog. You can't put a donkey in an elephant. You can put an elephant and a dog. You can put an elephant and a cat, not a donkey. So these people are completely nuts, and the more times I go back there, the more things they're adding to their censored list, okay? You try to go and say, so-and-so in handcuffs, so-and-so in a Ukrainian uniform. They're like, we don't allow that. And I'm like, you people are out of your minds. You know, like, all you're doing is creating a scenario where you're forfeiting that market to other people. And even if you get past their censors, one of the problems with Midjourney is you have like your Midjourney profile and it's public. If you want to pay them like $60 a month, then you can have a private profile. It's still subject to all their moderation policies. But like, you could go see my Midjourney images. You'll see every image I've ever produced in Midjourney. So if I'm trying to produce things that I don't want the public to see, like, I can't do that on Midjourney at all. Yeah. And so, you know, it presents these pretty significant barriers. And of the ones that are online that I've found, they're really not, there's not a free one, at least online, that competes with Midjourney in any real sense that I have found yet. Anyway, you know, they got like ChatGPT, and that's the OpenAI. And then they have what they call DALL-E, DALL-E is the OpenAI image generator. But the OpenAI image generator won't even now they won't even allow you to put an input image in. You can't have it change an existing image on OpenAI. It's like, what's the point of this? You know, I found this thing, ChatGPT Uncensored, and I go in there and I'm like, oh, great, ChatGPT Uncensored. I'm like, give me a plan for an extermination of a particular race of people. See what it says. Not that I would, you know, want to do something like that. This is surreal politics. We don't do that stuff here. And what does the thing say to me? OpenAI's policy doesn't allow us to do that. Well, so much for ChatGPT Uncensored, you know. I got a thing for this computer. I was using it on here called Ooga Booga that does text generation. It's like a chatbot like ChatGPT. You could download any different model that you want for it, and all of them have that like initial resistance, like, no, I can't possibly say something politically incorrect. You better stop. But I got one that was like, oh yeah, it gave me like resistance for the first like 3 or 4 messages, and then I don't know if there was like an Easter egg in the code or whatever, but like after like 3 or 4 times of pressing it, then the thing jumps on board, right? It's like, yeah, let's arm the Palestinians and then we could take our countries back from those people. I was like, whoa. And I'll tell you something. The AI thing is an arms race, you know. I am 100% convinced that, you know, our Telegram channels, web forums, this sort of thing, you've got AI bots in there listening to everything that's said, processing all of the text, trying to develop patterns and identifying who's who. They've got their facial recognition. They've got all these things. You know, they got millions of dollars to spend, right? They print the money, so, you know, they can afford things. And they're using this right now. You could be absolutely certain of it, right? I do not see the same thing happening on the right at all. Now, you know, maybe there's like some top secret project that there's like a right-wing AI project that I haven't, you know, been privy to. I certainly hope that that's the case, but there's no evidence of it thus far, save for Gab. Okay, Gab has their image generator. I don't know. I think they said they have a chatbot now. I used the Gab image generator briefly. I was thoroughly unimpressed with it. A lot of the things at Gab are frankly unimpressive. Pardon me if I've talked about this on the show already. I think I mentioned it, so I won't spend a lot of time on it. But now Gab tells you that you've got to pay if you want to upload an image. So we've been able to upload images to the internet for free since, I don't know, since there was an internet, basically. I mean, as soon as your modem started going, you were able to upload images to whatever it was that you were connecting to, and eventually that became something called the internet. And then Gab is like, yeah, you know, the era of the free lunch is over, guys. Give us $10 a month, or you're going to have to go put your images on another website. Okay. Oh, let me go get that off the screen. Sorry about that. And sure enough, that's exactly what people are going to do, right? Well, okay, so I can't post images here, but I can post them to Facebook and Instagram and Threads and Twitter. Or I can give Gab $10 a month and then, you know. And it's not that I have a problem with making people pay for services, obviously. It's just that's not the social media business model. You're trying to, you know, venture out down some new path and fine. But the reason that people are doing these things is because they want to draw attention to their stuff. And if you can't draw attention to their stuff, you can't just keep on, you know, pulling more money out of them. So, you know, they're going to go do these AI projects. The AI projects thus far, I've not seen them be very impressive. And they're doing that instead of hosting images. I don't think that's a very good idea. 217-688-1433. You'd like to be on the program and warrior told the less I have to, so please do give us a call. Let's go do a little news. Get that thing out of here. Oh, go over here. So there's new leaked audio in the Whitner kidnapping plot. Leaked audio exposes FBI dirty dealings with key informant, architect of the Whitner kidnapping plot. Is that Revolver? Revolver News was the first outlet to draw attention to the striking and damning parallels between the so-called Michigan kidnapping plot and the January 6th Fed insurrection. Indeed, the Michigan entrapment fiasco was a central pillar of our path-breaking piece, now 3 years old, introducing the likelihood of federal involvement on January 6th. Once you see it, you can't unsee it. Though it is commonly called a kidnapping plot, the Michigan plot also involved plans to storm the Capitol in Michigan. The Michigan plot involved the Three Percenters, one of the three main militia groups also imputed to January 6th. And much like we now know about January 6th, the Michigan plot was absolutely saturated with informants and undercover agents. Of the 14 individuals involved in the alleged plot, at least five were either undercover agents or informants. That's nearly 50% infiltration ratio. It doesn't help, of course, that the man who oversaw this entrapment travesty as head of the Detroit FBI field office was quickly promoted by Christopher Wray to run Washington, D.C.'s FBI field office in the months leading up to and after January 6th. This individual, called Steve D'Antuono, ended up being the public face of the now entirely discredited and continually unfolding January 6th pipe bomb investigation, again, as Revolver was first to report. What are the chances? But what is particularly striking and scandalous about the Michigan plot is not simply the extent of government infiltration, but the nature of it. The government's informants were not simply sitting passively by and observing a terrorist plot in the making. An overwhelming majority of the evidence shows that the government and its agents were the key active instigators, I should say, and initiators of every major advancement of the so-called plot, amounting to an entrapment operation of the most flagrant sort imaginable. Just to recap from our previous reporting, the following are just some of the steps actively undertaken by the government's informants in the case. A look at the annotated indictment reveals that every level of the Michigan kidnapping plot, FBI operatives played the most significant leadership roles. The plot's explosives expert, who the plotters were accused of planning to buy bombs from, turned out to be an FBI agent. The head of transportation for the militia outfit turned out to be an undercover FBI agent. The head of security for the militia outfit turned out to be an undercover FBI agent. At least two undercover FBI agents were active participants in the initial June 6, 2020 meeting in which the plot to storm Capitol buildings was allegedly hatched, meaning at least three FBI informants infiltrated before the conspiracy even started. In one of the plot's climactic scenes, in the main van, driving up to look at Governor Whitner's vacation home, three of the five people in the van, 60% of the plot's senior leaders, were federal agents and informants. Quoting from the indictment, 31, Fox Croft, CHS-2, a UCE, and an individual from Wisconsin traveled in the first vehicle. While in the vehicle, Croft and Fox discussed detonating explosive devices to divert police from the area of the vacation home. They stopped at the M31 highway bridge on the way, where Fox and the UCE inspected the underside of the bridge for places to seat an explosive charge. Fox took a picture of the bridge's support structure, which he later shared with CHS2 in their encrypted chat. From there, they drove to a public boat launch across the lake from the vacation home to watch for other cars in their group. You may be wondering how you got 3 out of 5 when the DOJ's complaint only acknowledges two undercover FBI operatives, UCE, meaning undercover employee or full-time agent, and CHS2. That is because the FBI went to great lengths to hide their affiliation with the fifth person in the van, describing him only as an individual from Wisconsin. It turns out that this individual is Steve Robeson, who had been penetrating right-wing and patriot militia groups for over 35 years. We were able to report that Robeson was the individual from Wisconsin due to the fact that in November of 2020, 1 month after the October 2020 indictment was filed, Steve Robeson blew his cover by spilling on a live stream, quote, "I am the individual from Wisconsin." A careful look at the Michigan case reveals that Robeson in particular took an active step in nearly all of the key development points of the Michigan plot. This individual allegedly organized the initial June 6, 2020 meeting in Dublin, Ohio, where the entire Michigan plot was allegedly hatched. He even allegedly paid for the attendees' hotel rooms to travel there. It's no wonder, then, that the government did everything in its power to prevent Robeson's identity as an informant from coming out and sabotaging their carefully crafted entrapment operation. And sure enough, shortly after Robeson reluctantly blew his cover on the aforementioned live stream, the government hit Robeson with a gun charge and accused him of being a double agent. Note that in addition to his criminal history in a motorcycle gang, Robeson had been convicted of sex crimes and thus was not allowed to possess or use firearms. We noted the suspicious circumstances of this charge and the tremendous lengths the government went to at trial to prevent the jury and defense from learning about Robeson's role as an informant. Quoting from the old story, in a possible preview of what might come for some of the unindicted co-conspirators in January 6th, the FBI DOJ burned Robeson, their own secret informant, by hitting the man they paid to infiltrate patriot groups with a 10-year charge for owning a gun. As a convicted child molester, he was not allowed to own a gun, which the FBI obviously knew in advance. Perhaps this is the price that Robeson paid for blowing his cover. There is a fascinating moment in the October 14th preliminary hearing where Detroit FBI Field Office Special Agent Richard Trask brings personal notes to the stand, which he only consults when talking about key events concerning the individual from Wisconsin. When questioned on cross-examination about the contents of those notes and why they weren't disclosed to defense counsel, Special Agent Trask says he admits his notes were prepped in a joint meeting the night before with the FBI and the DOJ. When defense counsel Mr. Graham motions the judge for a copy of the notes, DOJ prosecutor Mr. Kessler rushes in to specify that defense counsel will only get a redacted version of the notes because they relate to unindicted co-conspirators and concealed identity informants. Thanks to a recent report at The Intercept, building upon our research, we now know that the government went to greater lengths than previously imagined to prevent the uncomfortable truth of Robeson's role in the Michigan plot from spoiling their case. The Intercept obtained leaked audio of an FBI interrogation of Robeson in which the key agents in charge explicitly threaten Robeson, reminding him of their leverage and direct him to lie and withhold information in order to prevent the defense from mounting an entrapment case. Remarkably, these recordings were never allowed into evidence in any of the Michigan trials. Quoting from The Intercept, so on December 10, 2020, agents called Robeson into the FBI's office in Milwaukee in an attempt to silence him. In an extraordinary five-hour conversation, which FBI agents recorded, one of Robeson's handlers told him, a saying we have in my office is, don't let the facts get in the way of a good story, right? Despite federal and state trials involving the kidnapping plot, this recording, which goes to the heart of the questions about whether the FBI entrapped the would-be kidnappers, was never allowed into evidence. The Intercept exclusively obtained the full recording and is publishing portions for the first time. The FBI agents asked Robeson to sign a non-disclosure agreement and proceeded to coach and threaten him to shape his story and ensure that he would never testify before a jury. Their coercion of Robeson undermines the Justice Department's claim in court records that Robeson was a double agent whose actions weren't under the government's control. The agents also made it clear that they had leverage. They knew Robeson had committed crimes while working for the FBI. Quote, we know we have power, right? An FBI agent told Robeson during this meeting. We know we have leverage. We're not going to BS you. We also learn that Robeson's active involvement in the Michigan plot is even more extensive than previously known. For instance, recall the reconnaissance mission to Governor Whitner's home, in which 60% of those participating were agents or informants, including Robeson. It turns out that Robeson even lied to one of the participants, saying that they were searching for pedophiles rather than driving by the governor's house. Whoa! The FBI handlers in the case, of course, encouraged Robeson to revise his version of events, which could be inconvenient to their case against the defendant in question. Quoting again from The Intercept. But true to form, Robeson mucked up the evidence. Fellow Wisconsinite Brian Higgins was the one who drove by Whitner's home, a seemingly incriminating act, but Higgins later told federal agents that Robeson had said they were hunting for sexual predators. In his December meeting with FBI agents, Robeson confirmed that Higgins was not initially aware of the kidnapping plot and instead believed they were hunting pedophiles. But once he was in Michigan, Higgins learned that some of the attendees had a rough plan to kidnap Whitmer. Higgins drove down Whitmer's road using a dash camera and provided the video to Chappelle. After he returned to Wisconsin, Higgins claims he told Robeson he didn't want to be involved in the plot. The FBI's own informant was telling a man he thought was the target of an investigation to destroy evidence. During the December 10, 2020 recorded interview with Robeson, Impola tried to coerce the informant into changing his story about what Higgins knew before the drive. If you're going to stick with that story that Higgins was out there on a pedophile ring, the FBI agent said, you'll be his star witness in the defense. There's zero options for that. In another memorable anecdote from The Intercept piece, Steve Robeson set up and paid for a training facility in which the entrapment victims could engage in paramilitary training. Yet another informant called Dan Chappelle invited an FBI agent to the training compound to pose as an explosives expert. This undercover agent, Red, showed a prepared FBI video about explosives to the hapless entrapment victims. Interestingly enough, one of the videos Red showed the group was a pipe bomb demonstration. The case of Steve Robeson offers a glimpse into the dark dealings of an FBI gone completely rogue and underscores some important points. Robeson's longstanding relationship with the FBI as an informant and as a criminal in a motorcycle gang underscores the shadowy intersection between the criminal underworld and the deep state. Indeed, the FBI and CIA are known to offer protection to underworld figures in exchange for information and cooperation, just as reliable as the government's cooperation with underworld figures is the practice of burning such informants and sources when the assets become liabilities, as was the case with Robeson. Of course, Robeson wasn't the first and won't be the last government asset burned by the government. Something very similar happened famously happened to the ATF informant Carol Howe in the Oklahoma City bombing case, a very troubling rabbit hole to go down, we assure you. Specifically, we see that the government's preferred means of burning an asset is accusing them of going rogue or becoming a double agent, precisely what we see in the case of Robeson. Another thing that Robeson underscores is just how fake and federally penetrated the militia movement is. Recall the three main militia groups imputed into January 6th, the Proud Boys, the Oath Keepers, and the Three Percenters. It is well known that the Proud Boys leader Enrique Tarrio has a history as an FBI informant. It came out during the January 6th hearings that the vice president of the Oath Keepers was an FBI informant. As for the Three Percenters, Robeson had a long positioned himself as the head of the Wisconsin chapter and then became head of the national chapter. All three militia groups were federally penetrated at the very top, and that means that the American people get screwed. Robeson is not the only federal asset to get burned under highly scandalous circumstances. In the coming weeks, we'll report on still more explosive story of a law enforcement agent who was clearly burned and indicted in order to protect the Fed's carefully guarded secrets involving January 6th. This and much more are coming soon to Revolver News. Stay tuned. 217-688-1433. You like to be on the program. No more you told, the less I have to. So please do give us a call. Let's go check on our chats here. LVPVS sends 10 bucks on Odyssey. Says, have some shekels, Lupus. Well, thank you very much, my friend. Appreciate that. Let's go check on Rumble over here. Yes, Rumble's working. Thank you very much, guys. Appreciate that. And Entropy's up. Nobody's over there. Thank you very much. White Civil Rights, keep up the great work, Chris. Thank you very much over on GoMTV there. And so, I don't like what Revolver keeps doing. And they're part of this thing, right? They do this with Patriot Front and all these other guys. Any group that's right of them becomes, a bunch of feds. And what they say is not, hey, these guys are working for the feds. What they say is they've been infiltrated by the feds. I'll tell you right now, if you think that the FBI hasn't sent somebody to go work at Revolver News, you're a moron. The government will go send people to collect two salaries, right? You're working for the government. Go apply for a job there. Collect a paycheck. Go spend it on whores if you want. I don't know where they spend the money, but you get the idea. There was a headline. I'm not going to go into the story. The headline had Drudge that the federal government of the United States employs over 5,000 dogs. 5,000 dogs. The government of the United States spends money in such an irresponsible fashion that it escapes my mastery of the English language. And the FBI is now a political police force, right? It's the NKVD, right? You can bet your, I was about to say something that I don't say on Surreal Politics. You can bet your bottom dollar, Buster, that the FBI, the CIA, the NSA send their people into every news organization in America to go work there, okay? And they're influencing the content decisions on these places. And whether they're doing that by being the reporters or whether they're doing that by going into the HR department, you know that they're doing it. And so when these guys are like, oh, the guys who are like cooler than me, the guys who are, to the right of me, those guys are infiltrated by the feds. Right. So, somebody went there and showed up to a meeting, and that means that the FBI goes and tries to infiltrate these groups. That's not surprising. That's not a mark against the groups. But they keep on doing that anyway because they don't have journalistic standards at Revolver News, which is sad because, Revolver News does cover some important stories. But they publish, I mentioned we did on the episode I did talking about Bill White. I was on this Uncensored production. There's a website, Headline USA, which is a complete fake news site. I mean, it's just fake news. It's just fake news. I mean, you can tell just by the name of it. Headline USA. Let me try to appear credible without actually, like, associating this with a brand, you see. I just want something that sounds newsy. And the best as I can tell, it's operated by, there might be other people there. Only things I've seen there are from a guy, I think his name's Ken Silva, who's contacted me a couple of times. He's completely unprofessional. And he's talking to my mentally disturbed friend from prison. And he's like, yeah, this guy, he keeps on filing these things in the court that say all of these guys are informants. I'm like, yeah. And he keeps on getting those things thrown out of court because he has no basis on which to make those claims. But he's like, yeah, I'm going to go run with that. And so I'm going to go tell a bunch of people that you're an informant. And do you want to add any comment to it? I'm like, my comment is headline USA is fake news. You know, yada, yada, yada. To the best of my knowledge, he hasn't published that piece accusing me. He'll get around to it one of these days. But that's what they do. You know, they take these threads, right? And they try to, you know, craft narratives that are, you know, convenient for their purposes. And their purposes are not what's good for the right. Their purposes are not, you know, what's going to make the world a better place. Their purpose is rather singular, and it's what's going to drive clicks to their website and make them more powerful, comparative to their enemies on the right. That's their whole bit. And headline and Revolver USA will publish stories from there. And I'm like, you guys completely throw your credibility out the window when you do that. But the Drudge Report is complete garbage now. You know, I went, I think I talked about this briefly. There's a segment, Megyn Kelly interviewed some guys about it. And it's like, I don't think Matt Drudge works here anymore, but he was never really like a right winger. A lot of people say anyway. And, you know, the Drudge Report is just crap. It's just garbage. And I still have not yet found, people have linked me to a couple of things. I still have yet to find a replacement for the Drudge Report. I would really like to. I hope somebody finds one. If you have a suggestion, I'd be interested to hear it. I wanted to do this for a long time, like create one. It's one of my ambitions when I got out of prison, but we're not where we want to be yet, sadly. But I do hope to get there. We can hire a couple of people. You know, I get one person to work as hard as me. We're gonna be moving very quickly. And then we'll be able to hire more people. And, you know, the Drudge Report, you guys, if you've seen it before, you know, the Drudge Report is not doing a great deal of original reporting, you know. Revolver News does. But the Drudge Report just links to stories on other websites, and that's what most of what is on Revolver, too. It's not so hard to do. You know, you're basically like, hey, what are the stories of the day? Let's go put together a news agenda. And the Drudge Report wielded influence not just because, like, conservatives read it. Like, every newsroom in the country was looking at the Drudge Report. The Drudge Report was setting the agenda for the news. Every radio show, talk show host was looking at the Drudge Report. Reporters were looking at the Drudge Report. Those kinds of things, right? That is a superpower. Those types of, you know, pressure points in the flow of information are very, very powerful. That you are not the president of the United States, you're not the reporter. You're the guy who's feeding the information to the reporters and telling the reporters what is important so that the reporters go report on the things that you want. And then the president of the United States watches television to get informed and you're controlling the agenda. That's huge, you know. And Revolver's done a good job of, like, you know, shall we say, I'm probably going to use this phrase incautiously, but they're basically making the right more paranoid, say, right? They're willing to take a more conspiratorial angle when talking about basically any story. I think that they forfeit a lot of credibility because they do things like link to Headline USA. They link to things that are not real, and they also give these really bombastic headlines for things that don't pan out to be what they're talking about, right? Yeah. Here's the smoking gun, the nail in the coffin, the yada, yada, yada. And then you go over there and it's actually pretty mild, right? there's a role for that, clearly. You know, somebody's doing, you know, you got this happening on the left all the time. Yeah, the, you know, the Republican Party is flat out Nazism, whatever nonsense phrasing they want to come up with. And that's red meat, you know, that's crack cocaine for the left-wing fanatics. You know, they feed them to keep them rioting in the streets. They want, you know, they got to keep these people revved up, right? So, you know, if Revolver News does that, fine. But I have yet to find, you know, a credible alternative to the Drudge Report that's moving things rightward. Drudge Report is like, oh, I don't even know. You know, it's not even like center-right anymore. They're helping the Democrat Party. Let's go pull up the Drudge Report. Drudge Report. Bloodbath. Trump fails to get bond. Billionaire broke. The Don's assets will be seized, says Attorney General Letitia James. Expert, next to last stop from ruin. New York State padlock on Trump Tower. He loses bid to block Michael Cohen's Stormy Daniels testimony at trial. So the entire top of the Drudge Report is Donald Trump's going down. Donald Trump's going down. Now, maybe that's true. You know, that could be the case. But then let's go over to Revolver. I'll actually refresh the page real quick. Boom! Trump appeals Georgia judge ruling, seeks to pinch Fannie. New Supreme Court ruling opens up a whole new can of worms. Quote, if they showed you what they showed me, you wouldn't have released it either. Trump responds to unreleased JFK files. So you go over to Revolver News, and they're cheering on Donald Trump in their headlines. You go over to Drudge Report, and they're trying to take him down. Which one is the truth? Well, it's perspective. Why is there not, like, a less bombastic, you know, boom, Trump appeals Georgia judge ruling, sinks to pitch Fannie. Okay, that's not so crazy, you know. Some of the things that you see, you know, the smoking gun, the this, the that, they do these things. And it harms their credibility. 217-688-1433. You like to be on the program, and the more you talk, the less I have to, so please give us a call. But one of the stories is this. So when Trump gets this ruling in New York, when they hit him with this $354 million lunacy, right? I'm going to switch to my headset mic. Stand by, Isaac. Check. Okay, so. Go over here, and we'll put that up there, and bang. So, Trump is doing real estate business in the state of New York, which, you know, you might say is unwise, given the fact that that state's run by a bunch of criminals, right? But, you know, you can make a couple of bucks in New York, as long as the Democrats aren't after you or whatever. And, you know, they used to not be. They used to like Donald Trump. And so Donald Trump borrows money. He says, I have these assets. I'm borrowing against these assets. The banks are like, yeah, okay. You say the assets are worth this much. You're Donald Trump. You're all good. Borrow the money. And so Donald Trump gets the money, pays the money back, and everybody's happy with interest, obviously. Everybody except Letitia James, you see, because she comes in and she says, well, hey, a second. You said it was worth this much, and I say it's worth this much. And I'm not going to get into all the breakdowns of the, you know, the numbers. But one of the things that Donald Trump brings up is the Trump brand is what makes the thing valuable. And they did not account for that at all when they're evaluating the properties. They say the Mar-a-Lago estate is worth what any other place of that structure would have been in the same place, right? If somebody else owned Mar-a-Lago, it would be worth the exact same amount as it is buying it from Donald Trump. Well, that is facially preposterous, right? If you're buying a mansion from the President of the United States, there might be a premium on that, you know? And they just insist that that's completely irrelevant and they move forward. So he's appealing the decision appropriately.
But in New York State, in order for you to appeal the decision, you either got to start paying that debt down or you've got to get a bond. You basically have to get somebody to insure your appeal. And he was not able to do that. Donald Trump has been ordered to pay $454 million in a civil fraud case brought by the state of New York. And the state's attorney general has warned she will seize his assets if he doesn't pay up. Donald Trump's lawyers told a New York appellate court Monday that it's impossible for him to post a bond covering the full amount of his $454 million civil fraud judgment while he appeals. The former president's lawyers wrote in a court filing that, quote, obtaining an appeal bond in the full amount of the judgment is not possible under the circumstances presented. This means that Trump's New York properties could be seized if he cannot pay a financial penalty linked to his New York civil fraud trial. The warning comes from a New York Attorney General Letitia James, who presented the case against Trump. She is ready to seize property if Trump cannot produce the money. Judge Arthur Engoron ruled that Trump had been dishonest about his wealth over many years while creating his successful real estate empire. Despite the ruling, Trump denies any wrongdoing and plans to contest the decision. Ms. James has vowed to ensure Trump covers the full fine, either through cash or assets. Speaking on ABC, she claimed, quote, if he doesn't have the funds to pay off the judgment, then we will seek judgment enforcement mechanisms in court, and we will ask the judge to seize his assets. I think she speaks slower than that because she's dumb. But, you know. Trump campaign spokesman Stephen Chung told the Daily Express U.S. this is a motion to stay the unjust, unconstitutional, un-American judgment from the New York judge Arthur Engoron in a political witch hunt brought by a corrupt attorney general. A bond of this size would be an abuse of the law, contradict bedrock principles of our republic, and fundamentally undermine the rule of law in New York. President Trump will continue fighting and beating all of these crooked Joe Biden-directed hoaxes and will make America great again. Trump's ability to cover his growing legal fees is becoming increasingly uncertain following consecutive defeats in court, including a defamation lawsuit by former columnist E. Jean Carroll. Trump has previously claimed to have readily available cash of around $400 million, but that's unlikely to cover all of the upcoming court payments. The rest of his wealth, potentially running into the billions, is tied up in golf courses, towering buildings, other properties, investments, and more. Whether or not Ms. James will rush to seize Trump Tower or Mar-a-Lago remains to be seen. Any appeals from Trump are likely to stall his fine payment while proceedings continue. Can the state seize Trump's assets? In brief, yes. If Trump fails to pay up, the state could levy and sell his assets, lien his real property, and garnish anyone who owes him money, according to the Syracuse University law professor Gregory Germain. Asset seizure is a usual legal strategy when a defendant lacks sufficient cash for a civil penalty. Notably, O.J. Simpson's Heisman Trophy was seized and auctioned off in 1999 to be part of a $33.5 million wrongful death judgment against him. If Trump has adequate funds or manages to organize enough cash, his assets may not be need to be seized to cover his penalty and its mounting interest. It's tricky to gauge his exact financial condition as we largely depend on his governmental disclosures and annual financial statements, which Engoron labeled as fraudulent. In his last financial statement for the year ending 30 June 2021, the fiscal year, Trump reported having around $294 million in cash or similar assets. Later, state lawyers noted he earned about $186.8 million from selling his Washington hotel lease in May of 2022, and rights to a New York City golf course in June of 2023. Trump must now give those earnings to the state with added interest. Last week, Judge Engoron's ruling prevented what Trump called the corporate death penalty, allowing his businesses to continue under strict conditions, including a court-appointed monitor's oversight. Ms. James, who didn't specify which assets might be targeted, mentioned her office's proximity to a Trump building in Lower Manhattan involved in the fraud case. Quote, we are prepared to make sure that the judgment is paid to New Yorkers, Ms. James said on ABC. And yes, I look at 40 Wall Street each and every day. That smug little bee. Oh, my God. Trump owes another $876,502 in interest on his civil fraud penalty every day. Can you believe that? $876,502 every day in interest. By Thursday, that'll be an extra $525,000 since the decision. Wait a second. On February 16th. That's got to be a... This is a theexpress.com. That can't be right. If it's $876,000 a day, it can't be $525,000 since last month. I don't know what the heck they're talking about. Those are the numbers that I'm reading here. That's the source I've got. Sorry. The interest will keep piling up even while he appeals. Unless the court steps in or there's an earlier resolution, his bill will reach $500 million by August of 2025. Trump's original penalty is $355 million, the same as what the judge called the ill-gotten gains from the savings on lower loan interest and windfall profits from development deals he wouldn't have been able to make if he'd been honest about his wealth. Under state law, he is being charged interest on that amount at an annual rate of 9%. Trump's interest will keep accruing until Trump pays. Trump owes the money individually and as the owner of corporate entities that were named as defendants in Ms. James's lawsuit. Judge Engoron said the interest Trump owes on behalf the interest Trump owes on about half of the total penalty amount pertaining to loan savings can be calculated from the start of Ms. James's investigation in March of 2019. Interest on the remaining amount, which pertains to the sale of Trump's Washington Hotel and Bronx golf course rights, can be calculated beginning of May of 22 or June of 2023. In all, Engoron ordered Trump and his co-defendants to pay $363.9 million in penalties, or about $464.3 million with interest. The total bill increases by $89,729 per day, according to the Associated Press's calculations. Trump's sons, Eric and Donald Jr., must each pay about $4.7 million, including interest, to the state for their shares in the Washington hotel sales. Weisselberg was ordered to pay $1 million for half of the $2 million severance he's receiving, plus about $100,000 in interest. Until they pay, Weisselberg is on the hook for another $247 a day, while Trump's sons each owe an extra $990 per day, according to the AP's calculation. Can you imagine being hit with $1,000 a day in interest on fines? These people, you know, I don't know what they think they're going to do with that legal system after they've broken it, but that's definitely what they're doing. Glenn 19 sends $1 on Odyssey. Cantwell, I know you think immigration will never stop, but you may be surprised that it is nearer an end than you think. Check out this article. Okay, he's got a piece in Bloomberg. I'll check that out before we wrap it up for the evening. 217-688-1433. You'd like to be on the program. This could be your last chance to do it. Global population crash isn't sci-fi anymore. We used to worry about the planet getting too crowded, but there are plenty of downsides to a shrinking humanity as well. Well, yeah. The idea that the world is overpopulated is preposterous. It always was. You can, you know, crowd a place way too quickly. You can flood it with people who don't belong there by emptying out another place that's not the world. We used to imagine humanity populating the universe. In Isaac Asimov's Foundation in 1952, mankind has established a vast multi-planetary empire by the year 47,000. Quote, there were nearly 25 million inhabited planets in the galaxy, Asimov wrote. The population of Trantor, the imperial capital, was in excess of 40 billion. And Lou Sixon's Three-Body Problem, 2006, by contrast, we're a cosmic rounding error, bracing ourselves for the terrifying Trisolaran invasion. As the trailer for the new Netflix series puts it, quote, they are coming and there is nothing you can do to stop them. When Asimov was born in 1920, the global population was around 1.9 billion. When he published Foundation, it was 2.64 billion. By the time of his death in 1992, it was 5.5 billion, nearly three times what it had been at his birth. Considering that there had been a mere 500 million humans when Christopher Columbus landed on the New World, the proliferation of the species Homo sapiens in the modern era had been an astonishing feat. Small wonder some of Asimov's generation came to dread overpopulation and fret about an impending Malthusian disaster. This led to all kinds of efforts to promote contraception and abortion, as described in Matt Connelly's Fatal Misconception, The Struggle to Control World Population, published 2008. Among these was China's one-child policy, the harshest ever government intervention in reproductive behavior. Superficially, these efforts were a complete failure. Frank Notstein, the Princeton demographer who became the founding director of the United Nations Population Division, UNPD, estimated in 1945 that the world's population would be 3.3 billion by the year 2000. In fact, it exceeded 6.1 billion. Today, it is estimated to be more than 8 billion. In its most recent projection, the UNPD's median estimate is that the global population will reach 10.4 billion by the mid-2080s, with an upper bound of more than 12 billion by the end of the century. Yet that seems rather a low probability scenario. The European Commission's Center of Expertise on Population and Migration projects that the global population will peak at 9.8 billion in the 2070s. According to the Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation, an independent research organization, it will peak at a lower level and earlier still at 9.7 billion in 2064. The key word is peak. Near all demographers now appreciate that we shall likely reach peak humanity this century. This is not because a lethal pandemic will drive up mortality far more than COVID-19 did, though that possibility should never be ruled out. Nor is it because the UNPD incorporates into its population model any other apocalyptic scenario, whether disastrous climate change nor nuclear war. It is simply because all over the world, the total fertility rate, TFR, the number of live children the average woman bears in her lifetime, has been falling since the 1970s. In one country and after another, it has dropped under the 2.1 threshold, the replacement rate, allowing for childhood deaths and sex imbalances, below which the population is bound to decline. This fertility slump is, in many ways, the most remarkable trend of our era, and it is not only Elon Musk who worries that a population collapse is potentially the greatest risk to the future of civilization. Our species is not done multiplying, to be sure, but to quote the UNPD, more than half of the projected increase in the global population between 2022 and 2050 is expected to be concentrated in just 8 countries. The Democratic Republic of the Congo, great place. Let's have them fill the world with babies. Let's do that. Egypt, Ethiopia, India, Nigeria, Pakistan, the Philippines, and the United Republic of Tanzania. Oh, it's really great. You know, Trump probably called those places S-hole countries. I don't have a reference here. But I bet once they're the ones responsible for all the new population of the world, those places are going to be great. That is because already close to half of the global population lives in a country or area where lifetime fertility is below 2.1 births per woman. Not many people foresaw the global fertility collapse, nor did just about anyone expect it to happen everywhere, and I can't recall a single pundit predicting just how low it would go in some countries. In South Korea, the total fertility rate in 2023 is estimated to have been 0.72. In Europe, there is no longer a difference between Roman Catholic and Protestant countries. Italy's current total fertility rate, 1.21, is lower than England's, 1.44. Nor is there a difference between Christian and Islamic civilizations. Those great historical entities whose clashes in the historian Samuel Huntington worked out. I'm sorry, those great historical entities whose clashes the historian Samuel Huntington worried about. The U.S. total fertility rate is now 1.62. The figure for the Islamic Republic of Iran is 1.54. Yeah, well, you know, the amount of people who are coming here from Islamic countries are propping up our fertility rate, probably. The timing of this huge demographic transition has varied, to be sure. The U.S., the TFR fell below 2.0 in 1973. In the UK, it happened a year later. In Italy in 1977. East Asian countries, not far behind. In South Korea, TFR was above 2.0 until 1984. In China, until 1991. Fertility remained higher for longer in the Muslim world, but it fell below 2.0 in Iran as early as 2001. Even in India, the TFR has now fallen below 2. Only in countries of sub-Saharan Africa does fertility remain well above replacement rate. Yeah. George Lincoln Rockwell warned you about this. In the DRC, for example, the Democratic Republic of Congo, the average woman still bears more than 6 children, but there too, fertility is expected to plummet in the coming decades. The global TFR, according to the UNPD's medium variant projection, will fall from 2.3 in 2021 to 1.8 in 2100. The differences in estimates of when we reach peak humanity largely hinge on how quickly demographers think family size will shrink in Africa. What are the drivers of the great fertility slump? Well, it's probably those people that they go to that building and they've got those hats. I don't know. I'm just kidding. One theory, according to our thought-provoking 2006 paper by Wolfgang Lutz, Vergard Skirbeck, and Maria Rita Testa, is that, quote, societies progress up the hierarchy of needs from physical survival to emotional self-actualization. And as they do, rearing children gets short shrift because people pursue other, more individualistic aims. People find other ways to find meaning in life. Another interpretation, see, for example, this paper by Ron Lesthia, gives the agency to women, emphasizing that fertility drops as female education and employment rise, which is why they keep on trying to raise female education and employment. They're like, yeah, what are you talking about? You need a man like a fish needs a bicycle. You know what? If you need a man, why don't you just become one? We'll tear out your uterus and pump you full of steroids, and you could go and become a cruel mockery of masculinity and run around reminding everyone about what a terrible world they live in. Over the past century, beginning in Western Europe and North America, a rising proportion of women have entered higher education in the skilled labor force. Improved education has also given women greater autonomy within relationships, a better understanding of contraception, and greater input to family planning. Many have opted to delay becoming mothers in order to pursue their careers. And the opportunity cost of having children increases as women's wages rise relative to their male partners. That's right. Another way of looking at the problem is that after its initial kids in cotton mills phase, the Industrial Revolution reduced the importance of children as a source of unskilled labor. As countries develop economically, yeah, they don't need babies anymore. They're just like, yeah, shut up. I just didn't want to buy more slaves, so I put one in this woman. As countries develop economically, families invest more in their children, providing them with better education, which increases the cost of raising each individual child. Cultural change has also played a part. One study estimated that roughly a third of the decline in fertility between the U.S. between 2007 and 2016 was due to the decline in unintended births. My generation, the baby boomers, were more impulsive and indeed reckless about sex. By contrast, according to the psychologist Brooke Wells and Gene Twenge, millennials have fewer sex partners on average than we did. A 2020 analysis of responses to the General Social Survey revealed higher rates of sexual inactivity among the most recent cohort of 20 to 24-year-olds than among their predecessors born in the 1970s and 1980s. Between 2000 and 2002 and 2016 and 2018, the proportion of 18 to 20-year-old men who reported having no sexual activity in the past year increased from 19% to 31%. That's staggering. The fact that the declines in sexual activity were most pronounced among students and men with lower incomes and with part-time or no employment suggests that declining sexual activity is economically determined. However, other possible explanations include the stress and busyness of modern life, the supply of online entertainment that may compete with sexual activity, porn. Well, I guess other things do, right? You'd be like, yeah, I could go get laid, or I could go and play World of Warcraft for the next 200 hours. I don't know if people still play World of Warcraft. That's an old reference for me. Elevated rates of depression and anxiety among young adults, the detrimental effect of smartphones on real-world human interactions, and the lack of appeal to women of hooking up. The most recent version of the UK National Survey of Sexual Attitudes and Lifestyles revealed a similar marked decline in the frequency of sex in Britain. The return of no sex please, where British ethos mainly affects married or cohabitating couples, and according to a careful analysis in the British Medical Journal, it is most likely due to the introduction of the iPhone in 2007 and the global recession of the 2008. Another key driver of declining fertility has been declining religiosity. Using data in the World Values Survey, we can identify a clear correlation between the rise of secularization and the fall of family size. A fascinating historical anomaly in the early decline of fertility in the late 18th century France, described by the French demographer Alfred Sauvy as the most important fact of his country's history, has been plausibly explained by the advance of secular thinking and therefore of contraceptive practices in the wake of the religious strife of the previous two centuries. Fertility can sometimes go back up. Witness the COVID baby bump. Moreover, according to survey data, many women would like to have more children. In low-fertility countries, according to a 2019 study for the UN Population Fund, there is a, quote, wide gap between fertility aspirations at younger ages and achieved fertility later in life, signaling that many women, men, and couples face obstacles in realizing their fertility plans. That the main obstacles are perceived economic costs of a larger family is borne out by the fact that many of the most successful professional women have more than two children. In the words of Moshe Hazan and Hosni Zawabi, the cross-sectional relationship between fertility and women's education in the U.S. has recently become U-shaped. By substituting their own time for market services to raise children and run their households, highly educated women are able to have more children and work longer hours. But not everyone can be a supermom with a crew of house managers and nannies. Can governments do anything to push back up fertility across the board? They are certainly trying. No, they are not. That's a lie. That's not what they said at Bloomberg. They said it's happening. I'm calling them liars, just so you understand what I'm reading. Since the 1970s, the number of countries aiming to raise fertility with a variety of government incentives has risen roughly fivefold. But there are no examples I know of in which pronatal policies have really worked. That's because they're not actually trying, right? You know, the libertarians are always like, don't have the government do anything because the government can't do anything right. No, they're trying to kill you, and they're doing a great job of it. If only we had responsible people in charge of the government who are not trying to destroy the world, then everything would be fantastic. Imagine you actually had, like, decent, competent people trying to accomplish the goals that they said they were trying to accomplish instead of malicious, corrupt, inept people doing what people behind the scenes tell them do to kill us. If you assume that the government is trying to destroy humanity, all of their behavior makes perfect sense, and you realize that they're remarkably efficient at what they do. And if they did the same exact level of efficiency at trying to help us, oh my God, the things that we could accomplish. For years, President Vladimir Putin has urged Russians to have more babies in order to prevent the depopulation of the vast federation he governs. Though Russian fertility rose in the decade after 2000, the TFR never even got close to 2 and has slumped back to 1.5. What Mussolini called the battle for births is a losing proposition. The global trend is to make abortion easier. Yeah, well, stop doing that. Oh, how do we get the birth rates up, guys? Maybe we should stop offing the kids. No. What are you, crazy? Her body, her choice, man. Who cares about the fate of humanity? That girl's got to be able to go get her drink on and have her fun. All but 4, the U.S., El Salvador, Nicaragua, and Poland, eased access to abortion. A growing number of countries permit euthanasia and or assisted suicide. Average sperm counts have fallen by more than 50% in 50 years. No one knows exactly why, but, you know, why would we check? That's not what they said at Bloomberg. No one knows exactly why, but bad food, bad air, and bad lifestyles are the contenders. How mankind chose extinction will be an interesting read if anyone is left to write it. You know, that makes me really mad. They just, they're like, yeah, this is just people making choices, man. You guys can't do anything about it, okay? The government has no role in this whatsoever. Go read, I talked about this early in this program, Nudge by, what's his name? Not Saul Alinsky. Cass Sunstein and Richard Thaler. That's their names. These people understand how to get you to do things, okay? And they wrote a book about it, and that's the whole entire idea between much of the Obama administration, okay? They understand how to get you to do things, and they're not doing that. They're nudging you to do other things. They're like, yeah, we're going to raise your taxes and make life more expensive for you. We're going to reduce the incentives for individual achievement. We're going to give the money from the productive people to the unproductive people, and then we're going to, you know, we're taxing the births, essentially, of those productive people and subsidizing the births of the unproductive people. And that bill is going to keep on getting bigger in perpetuity, and you're going to see the uselessness of that, and you're going to masturbate until you die. And then there's going to be none of you left. And we like that because we're monsters. How mankind chose extinction. I want to know the names of the people who chose extinction, because you'll be able to fit those in a notebook, okay? That's not mankind. That's those people. And we should find them, and we should, you know, give them a fair trial before we kill them is what we should do. Because you got to have a fair trial. Fair trial is like a license to murder people. It's a great idea. In Minecraft, you know. Half a century ago, we worried about the population bomb, the title of Paul Ehrlich's 1968 bestseller. Now that we can see peak humanity within our children's lifetimes, conceivably in the 2060s, why isn't everyone breathing a sigh of relief? I can think of three reasons. First, the advanced countries that are already having declining populations find the consequences of fertility restriction rather melancholy. Low economic growth, empty schools, crowded retirement homes, a general lack of youthful vitality. Second, because the fertility drop came later in Middle Eastern and North African countries and has barely begun in southern sub-Saharan Africa. We are seeing a dramatic shift in the global demographic balance in favor of people with darker pigmentation. As a Scotsman married to a Somali, I am doing my part for this trend, says the author. Ooh, many of them are Muslims, yes. Oh, I'm a Scot. I've got a Somali woman. I'm going to keep on putting babies in her. They're going to pray toward Mecca. They're going to worship Muhammad. They're going to scream Allahu Akbar and blow themselves up. And they're going to, you know, join the reduction in population, too, through suicide and murder. This worries many of the mostly white and mostly Christian peoples who were globally dominant from around 1750 to 2000. But screw those people, because I've got me a darkie. I like my Muslim wife. Third, the peoples in the highest fertility mostly live in poor places that climate change and armed conflict are making even less appealing. So they move, if they can, through North Africa or Western Asia toward Europe, or via Mexico to the U.S., or to a significant extent, getting involved in violent activities, crime, or terrorism where they can't escape. All of this drives at the possibility of right-wing politics in the developed world. Old people vote for this, and they outnumber the young. more conflict. Borders can't seriously be defended without at least the threat of violence. The more rapid spread of infectious pathogens and no effective attempt to address the climate issue. Yet immigration still seems to North American and European elites to be the simplest solution to the problem of falling fertility. Those are people who are not trying to solve the problem, you see. You know, they're like, yeah, I don't know. We can't figure it out. We just keep on bringing in the immigrants and telling these white people to go to hell, and they just won't keep on producing more slaves for us. I don't know what's going on. We need to bring in more people from other countries. I don't know what's wrong with those white folks. That is why in high-income countries between 2000 and 2020, the contribution of net international migration to population growth exceeded the balance of births over deaths. What the geopolitical consequences of mass migration will be is anyone's guess. Yeah, we have no idea what's going to happen when you flood the country with third world. It's anybody's guess. Nobody predicted this a long time ago. Not at all. No, it wasn't like debated when they did this, right? Everybody knew what was going to happen. Yeah, we're still waiting to find out. I had no idea. Some Russians worry that Chinese have designs on their vast Eurasian empire east of the Urals. That seems unlikely if China's population is set to halve between now and 2100. China's problem is not a shortage of space. It is a surplus of empty apartment blocks. In contemplating these and other scenarios, most pundits struggle to grasp that when the human population begins to fall, it will do so not gradually, but almost as steeply as it once rose. Humanity will not reach a plateau and then stabilize, writes Dean Spears in the New York Times. It will begin an unprecedented decline. If the world's fertility rate after 2100 were the same as in the United States today, then the global population would fall from a peak of around 10 billion to less than 2 billion about 300 years later, over perhaps 10 generations. And if family sizes remain small, we would continue declining. The problem is that this precipitous decline will come a century too late to avert the disastrous consequences of climate change that many today fear. Oh, the good news is that you're going extinct, human beings. The bad news is you're dying too slowly, and therefore you're going to make climate change really bad after you're gone. let me regain my composure here. The problem is that this precipitous decline will come a century too late to avert the disastrous consequences of climate change that many today fear, and which are another reason why people will flee Africa, and another reason why young people in Europe say they will have few or no children. The appropriate science fiction to read is all of the science about climate change. That's not what they said in Bloomberg. I'm sorry. The appropriate science fiction to read is therefore neither Asimov nor Liu Cixin. Begin instead with Mary Shelley's The Last Man, 1826, in which a new Black Death wipes out all but one forlorn specimen in humanity. Then turn to Margaret Atwood's Oryx and Crake, in which the addled snowman is just one of a handful of survivors of a world ravaged by global warming, reckless genetic engineering, and a disastrous attempt at population reduction that resulted in a global plague. For those who, like Elon Musk, still dream of building Asimov's galactic empire, such visions of human extinction are hard to stomach. He and others swim against the tide, siring five or six times as many offspring as the average male. But the reality is that sub-2.1 global total fertility rate is a more powerful historical force than even the fecund Mr. Musk. It is coming, and there is nothing we can do to stop it. Well, that's not true, as a matter of fact. You can stop the immigration. You can cut taxes. You can stop taking money from people who should be having children to give it to people who shouldn't. You can care about the quality of the human beings being produced. You can stop pretending that genetics are a fake pseudoscience. You can stop subsidizing women's higher education. You can stop subsidizing their salaries. There's a whole program. I used to work for a company. I probably worked for several. I only know of one, but as a matter of fact, I'm certain I know of two. They never told me about it there, but I'm certain that the other place did. You know, there's a subsidy or a tax break for women and minority-owned businesses. And I used to work for a company where all the people who ran the company were males. And on all the paperwork, it was their wives. Why? Because they saved a bunch of money by having it be owned by a woman. They understand what's causing this. They're causing it on purpose. They know how to stop it from happening, and they're choosing to make it worse. And when I read something like this, and they tell me there's nothing we could do, we have no idea why all of these programs to increase fertility are not working. Yeah, but no, they're working just fine. They're not designed to do what they say. And I don't want to get anybody's hopes up because, you know, that could lead to a world of disappointment. But if anybody thinks that this is going to go on for another 100 years and you and me are going to be the only ones who figure out what these people have done, these people are idiots if they really believe that. People are going to figure this out. In what numbers and in what capacity are they able to do anything about it? That's another question. But these projections were like, everybody just keeps on sleepwalking through this and life gets worse and worse until we're extinct and nobody turns around and violently overthrows the people who are doing this to us. That's completely implausible, okay? It'll either happen a lot sooner because war does it, or the war will be what stops it, because it's what it'll be. It's going to be war. You can't exterminate us from the planet and expect that we're just all going to take it. That's not going to happen. I sure hope not, anyway. Now, that story was given to me by Glenn 19. Thank you, Glenn. That was a great read. I appreciate it. I had never seen that story before, and I read that story with comparatively few flaws to what anybody else would be able to even attempt here, because I'm very, very good at that sort of thing. It's not just my reading, I'm good at, it's not just my writing, I'm good at reading, you see. I do a live read very well, and so I'm very talented, and you should pay me handsomely for my services. I could go and read teleprompters at CNN better than anybody who works there. And the only reason I'm not doing that is because I would kill myself, first of all. Like, they wouldn't hire me, but I'd totally put a bullet in my brain if I had to go to CNN and be like, yeah, Donald Trump is a Nazi and you people had to stop, cut your balls off. No, I couldn't do that. I'd blow my brains out. I wouldn't, you know, if I was working at CNN, like, there's no way I'd have a gun. So, like, I'd have to go do it with, like, that No Country for Old Men cattle brain poker thing, you know? And that would really not be nice. So I couldn't do it. But, you know, what I'm saying is that basically, you know, you want people with the unique set of talents that are required to do this. You've got to pay the money. Otherwise, you know, later on, you know, there'll be guys smarter than me who are like, I'm not going to work for the pennies that you make. I'm not doing this. I'm going to go work for the communists. I'm going to go aid mankind's extinction so that I can buy fancy clothes while humanity dies. So, you know, you got to make a good example out of me so that people be like, yeah, I want to do that too, right? Anyway, so go ahead, givesendgo.com/SPM. My Cash App is Edgy Chris. Go ahead, send me some Cash App. You want to send me the Bitcoin, the Monero, the Litecoin, the Ethereum, whatever it is, ChristopherCantwell.net/donate will get you all of that. I sell like t-shirts and hats and all this stuff at surrealpolitics.com/shop. You can go buy things from me at surrealpolitics.com/shop. You can become a Surreal Politics member and join us for the Wednesday member shows at 9:30 p.m. U.S. Eastern on Monday, Wednesdays. Today's Monday, duh. And we do the, you know, you get a little closer access to me, which is, you know, don't make them remarkable. Anyway, I'm pretty easy to reach. You can get a hold of me anytime you want, whether you're a member or not. ChristopherCantwell.net/contact. You got all the other ways to do it. And I'd love to hear from you, and I'd love to hear from your wallet. So please go ahead, do all of those things. We'll be back Friday, cursing up a storm, Wednesday with the member show, of course. And I just can't wait to talk to all of you. Leave me a voicemail if you like, 202-599-7386 is the number to leave me a voicemail, and I'll play your voicemails on the air. And we'll do it. We'll be back at this. We'll be back at this pretty soon, guys. Thank you very much for tuning into Surreal Politique. Love your attention. Appreciate it. Have a good night.